Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Dedicated to Henry Foreman. In the year of the primal force.
It is Tuesday, the 21st of March, and this is Alan Averill. You're listening to Agitators Anonymous, Tuesday's Heavy Metal Miscellany. The 10th primordial album is sort of just about in the bag, being wrapped up, all that kind of thing. So I am in the middle of fixing artwork, mastering, mixing, all that kind of stuff. And the final procedure that goes into making an album, which I'll discuss along with a few other things on the podcast on Friday. But today's podcast, to spare me a little bit of time, but it's also pretty fucking cool. You may have noticed over on my YouTube channel, I do these things called the Metal Salvage Chats with Joe from Gamma Bomb. And we have a drink, we talk heavy metal, we get into the minutiae, the nerdy detail and detailism, whatever you want to call it, of just being obsessed nerds about 80s heavy metal or 70s hard rock or 90s, whatever you want. And what we did is we made a pretty cool video recently about the albums of 1983. Think about that. Show No Mercy, Kill 'Em All, Shout of the Devil, Into Glory Ride, Melissa. There's tons of them. So what I'm going to do here right now is show you part four of that chat, which includes three out of those four tasty morsels, which we discuss. If you want to check out parts one and two, and also three, you can go over to my YouTube channel, just put in Alan Averill, and you'll find it, and you can watch the rest of it, and you can see our ugly mugs discussing these things, and lots of other stupid nonsense. But today's Tuesday, Heavy Metal Miscellany is a chat about some of the heavy-hitting albums from 1983, and what an incredible year it was for some of the game changers that came to heavy metal. All right, enjoy.
Stopped you mid-salute there, so salute away. There you go, okay.
Kill 'Em All. All for One. Born Again. Like, what's good about Born Again, apart from the fact that it exists and it's a novelty, like, you know?
I have a few people I know who swear by it, and I think they're just being pedantic. Do you know what I mean? I think they're being, like, weird about it, you know?
Like, I think the album cover is legitimately really, really interesting. And I think songs like Digital Bitch and stuff are funny. But I don't know. Like, maybe there are. I think that if there are any Sabbath fans who are watching this, who listen to this album and think it's great, but don't listen to the Tony Fat Cat Martin era, then they're fooling themselves.
Yeah,
this album is nowhere near as good as a lot of those records, you know?
I like the soft focus pictures of the band. I only listened to this actually yesterday. It's the reason why I just happened to be sitting there. The soft focus sort of Mills and Boone photos of the band were in the back where they look kind of like, I mean, Geezer looks like something from like an early 80s Benidorm sitcom where he's like a waiter who woos a kind of stuffy English woman on in Corfu or something, you know?
Who plays drums on this record?
It's Bill Ward.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, Crashed, Stonehenge, Disturbing the Priest is all right. The Dark Zero, the Hero, dun, 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 that's kind of cool enough song. Digital Bitch, yeah, it's Born Again. It's an album that seems to be the product of my fucking squeaky chair. It seems to be a product of a lot of booze and cocaine, I would wager. Yeah. And I think
this is an album as well, kind of like what we talked about a couple of these records, like Another Perfect Day and stuff, and like we'll get on to Daily Mount Park and stuff. But
oh yeah,
there was a lot of people making records where they're saying, I'm not playing any of those songs. You know, I think whenever they were doing this tour, you got to hear Smoke on the Water and like Children of the Grave or something, and then just a whole new album. Like, I don't think Gillan was into the idea of doing Dio or Ozzy era stuff, the same way as Brian Robinson said, I don't want to play any of those songs that your fans love, you know?
Well, by all accounts, that Daily Mount gig, he had all his lyrics on the floor, and the dry ice was that dry ice that doesn't move. It just sort of sits. Early 80s kind of stuff, and he came out to sing, and he couldn't see his lyrics for Iron Man because he didn't bother to learn the songs. Bent down to move the ice, split his trousers, and had to be ferried back to the backstage, which, of course, was like 100 meters away, some porter cabin, and then driven back. So Sabbath... So the mythology goes, played the first two songs instrumental.
See, for people who don't know, this is a couple of times in the late 70s and early 80s they tried to have a heavy metal festival in Ireland, in Daly Mount Park.
Yeah, I'll bring up the picture of it.
But it was a cacophony of just like unloved lineups, like Diamond Head doing Canterbury, Motorhead doing Another Perfect Day, you know, Born Again. Like, you could see how Twisted Sister must have just come on and blown everyone off the stage.
Well, this was Sunday, the 28th of August, Daily Mount Stadium. But the pictures of it doesn't look fucking full at all. The pictures...
Yeah, it always looks like there's very few people there. Look.
It looks like there's about 7,000 or 8,000 people there, not 20 or 25. But you've got Mammoth Boys opening, Anvil, Diamond Head, Twisted Sister, Motorhead, Black Sabbath. So that's Diamond Head on Canterbury, Motorhead on Another Perfect Day, and Black Sabbath on Born Again. Weird, like on albums that were all poorly received that year. And you could, yeah.
It was
probably
fucking raining as well. Like, you know?
Yeah, the photos, there's a few photos, and it looks overcast, but of course it's going to be overcast. It's Ireland in the 1980s. It wasn't the whole decade overcast. And didn't Dee Snider have his picture taken with the Lord Mayor or something? Which made the cover of the Daily Star or something?
Yeah, there was an old thing where you could ask for the keys of the city or get the keys from the city from the Lord Mayor if you're a visiting dignitary, which I think when they enacted this law meant an American. So if you're an American who came to Dublin, you could meet the mayor and do all this. But it's funny, as we were saying, like, you know, Sabbath were out on tour with Diamond Head, you know, doing Canterbury and Born Again, which is just, you could see how a lot of people were not plussed, or there were only 7,000 people there, whereas maybe in, you know, 1986 or 1978 there would have been 20,000 people there, you know.
I mean, yeah, there's pictures of it online, a couple of pictures. The stage looks, of course, super weird and unprofessional. It looks sort of like a rather big tent, but it appears to be sort of pink or orange on the underside of the tent. I mean, look, I think you know what it was like without having to look at the pictures, you know, totally. 1983 in Ireland. But yeah, Born Again, I know some people like, and there is something kitschy and weird about the record. Like, it's a weird listen. It's a very weird snare. But, you know, and there is some cool parts on it. There's some genuinely vaguely dark sort of moments in the music. But as a whole, I find Gillan's voice on it fucking bugs me, you know?
My thing where I think about it is that before Dio joined the band, they were in a place where, I think it was Technical Ecstasy, they went to Florida to make the album. And I'd been there for 5 months, spent like 20 grand a month on coke, and not recorded anything. And when the record company came there after 5 months, they were like, yeah, we haven't done anything. We've just been going nuts in Florida. Like... So I think that once Dio had left the band, and, you know, it was Bill Ward and Geezer and Tony, they probably were just like, do you want to just go totally nuts, like, and not give a fuck about what sort of album you come out with? And they're like, yep.
Well, Jeff Nichols was there, wasn't he? Iommi's party buddy, who was from Ports, was it? And he was, wasn't he kind of like keyboards and fixer?
Man about town.
Yeah. It's It's a weird, and the artwork has taken on a sort of kitschy cool as well for some people, you know. Wouldn't be the first time I've seen a blue t-shirt of this and some 18-year-old kid, you know. But it's weird.
I see it frequently, and like a proper old-fashioned old fat boy, I feel like going up to those people and being all like, do you like this album, or is it just, do you like the album cover? That's fine, like, they just like the album cover, but, like, you know.
Yeah.
You know. Again, I mean, I would say that if anyone who's really into this, you should really be listening to the Seven Sign or, you know, one of their
deep albums. I love that, the Glenn Hughes record, Seven Star, I love that. But, I mean, Headless Grass, Tear, and Eternal Idol. After this, I don't recognize Sound Barrier, Total Control. Flick of the Switch. Wow.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up and just say it. Like, so they're clearly on auto cruise here. Like, you know, the drop in quality that we got on For Those About to Rock, it went down again, didn't it?
I don't know. I mean, I did the AC/DC thing with Addy from Solstafear, and both of us agreed that outside of the 70s and the first two in the 80s, the best albums, and I think there's Flick of the Switch and Wallbreaker, arguably. But Flick of the Switch, I think this is a good record. It just, okay. It's a good hard rock record. It's solid. It's got some great songs in it, like Landslide, Brainshake, Guns for Hire is a classic. But it's a hard-nosed record that doesn't have the huge production of Mutt Lange, the big choruses. It's got better songs on it than For Those About to Rock. Like, if you Line of the Long Knives, you know, whatever, what the fuck is that? I put the Finger on You, and not bad songs, but I would take Guns for Hire over some of those songs.
Guns for Hire is definitely a better song.
Yeah, Nervous Shakedown is all right. Flick of the Switch as an opener, as a title track, is cool. The artwork always it mystifies me. It's very weird, but it's kind of cool. It's a weird idea. That's just like a pencil sketch. It's more that the logo.
It seems like a kind of continuation of the last album cover, where they're like, right, okay, let's not do something zany. Let's just have something. But then, like, it looks like a masterpiece. Is the next album Fly on the Wall?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
And then Blow Up Your Video, where, like, it was literally the shittest album covers they could think of. Looking.
You get Who Made Who, then you get Blow Up Your Video. Blow Video, I think, is 88. Fly on the Wall is maybe 85. But Flick of the Switch, I think Flick of the Switch is an underrated record in the AC/DC canon that deserves more of a listen. But I understand, you can understand why it failed, because it doesn't have any hits on it. They fired Mutt Lange, they fired all the backroom staff, they fired all the people who worked in the studio. They went, bollocks, we'll do it ourselves.
And you would also say, man, that, like, you know, the failure of Flick of the Switch would have been an outrageous success for Saxon, Power and Glory. Like, they were literally just going down by X million, but they were still selling millions of copies of Flick of the Switch.
I think I read that the lowest selling record is Fly on the Wall, and it's not certified very high. It's just a couple of million, maybe even. And so they went from selling, they have one of the greatest or biggest selling albums of all time. And three albums later, they were down to, they could still fill a stadium. They were filling a stadium for people hearing You Shook Me All Night Long, not hearing Shake Your Foundations, which I think is a fucking great song, but, you know.
But this is one of these classic kind of things that I think around this era, like, and the same thing happened, Diamond Head, the third single off the album was a live version of You Shook Me All Night Long, or, a, you know, in Diamond Head's case, a live version of Sucking My Love, because they were clearly like, shit, people are not really liking these new singles. What about just doing a live version of one of the songs that people do like as a single? Like,
yeah, I have some. I do have some singles. I think the singles were Nervous Shakedown and Guns for Hire, I think, were the singles. But I stand by this record. I think it's a good record. But I'm a fan of Fly on the Wall. But I think this is a good. I think this
totally.
Is a,
and you can imagine record. How fucking if they had played in the RDS in 1983, like, you know,
I'm sure they did. Yeah,
I'm sure Ireland at that stage was going AC/DC mad, because, like, cultural phenomenons like Back in Black frequently don't get to places like Ireland until a couple of years later. So I would say that, like, in 1983, people were discovering AC/DC and going insane, you know, I mean, on a huge level, rather than because obviously they'd been here in the 70s, you know.
I think there's a bit of also snobbery of people who just only want to listen to 70s AC/DC. I get it. I mean, look, what's much better than Power Age? The answer is fuck all. But
the second hour of the podcast, and we'll have to bring up the traditional subject of Dokken, like Dokken, you know, breaking the chains.
Oh, that's this year. Hang on, let's go to the Trust.
Am I missing any in between here?
Trust, with a very black metal looking cover, Ideal. I've never heard this record, I must be honest. I never really give a shit about Trust.
I don't really like them, to be honest with you.
Well, Dokken, September the 18th, Breaking the Chains, Breaking the Chains. This is the first Dokken record I bought a long, long, long time ago. And I liked the opening track and I liked one or two other tracks, Knight Rider. But I think I bought it in 92 or something like this. I found it on CD for like £3. And I'd heard about Dokken. I didn't really know Dokken yet. They weren't a band I liked in the 80s. I knew of them. I knew songs here and there, but I didn't have a copy of Under Lock and Key in 1988 or 89. They were just not on the radar in Ireland, you know? And then I saw Breaking the Chains. It might have even been a year or two earlier than that. Might have even been 1991 maybe. And I bought it, didn't really like it. It sat in my CD collection for years. And it wasn't until maybe end of the 90s I began to really get super into Dokken. But it's interesting because it's like songs from like 1978 and 79 all the way up.
Yeah. You know? He had a kind of collection of songs as a songwriter. A lot of people probably don't realize this, but like back in the day, Don Dokken was a rhythm guitar player, singer kind of guy. And he'd been attached with bands, with people from Wasp and a whole bunch of different things. And this album was originally recorded a couple of years earlier whenever he was
in Germany
to sing on Blackout by the Scorpions. And there is a cool, like it's got a way better front cover, right? The Don Dokken solo record, Breaking the Chains.
Well, there's also
he ended up to something, isn't he? Being all like,
yeah. Well, there's also there's the Back on the Streets, the sort of Germany '82 recording of this record, because they were playing in Germany in '82 with no record out yet, which was so bizarre. And they recorded the album in Germany.
It was like Dieter, whatever his face is, the guy who was the manager and producer for the Scorpions. He was obviously friendly with Dokken in some regard, so that he said, listen, Klaus has lost his voice here and we'll have to start working on Blackout. So you come in and sing on the demos, we'll delete your vocals, and as a favor for doing that, I'll get my assistants, basically the engineers, to make your solo album and you can tour around Germany and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I think that, like you said, that was like 81. And then I think there was a period of like inactivity basically for about a year and a half where there was nothing doing. And then somehow they got into a situation where the guy from the Scorpions their manager had convinced Q Prime and Elektra to pick up Dokken. And then he rang the guy's, what's his face, George Lynch and stuff, and said, listen, this Dokken thing's back on, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's now, I like the record more now than I did when I heard it 30 odd years ago. I like the cover.
It's the worst of their 80s records, is it?
Hmm?
Is it the worst of their 80s records?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, it's the cover sort of freaks me out in a weird way. It reminds me of something of a computer game from 1983 or something, you know?
I think it looks weirdly futuristic, but it certainly looks shit, you know? They did paid apparently like hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy on to Blue Oyster Cult
tour
for Fire of Unknown Origin, which is like a BOC album from that year, Fire of Unknown Origin, sorry, Revolution by Night, which is, I like it, but it was a Bruce Fairbanks produced kind of attempt at making a pop album, and it went really badly. So I think Dokken had paid all this money to do an arena tour where they were playing to half empty arenas.
Right.
And then they came back and like their label were just like.
It's got some good songs. I mean, it's got Paris is Burning on it, hasn't it? It's got Felony with some rather
We're Illegal.
Yeah. Well, next on the list, September the 23rd, Kiss, Lick It Up.
Is there anything good to say? The key change in Lick It Up is inspired, like, isn't it? Like, you know,
I kind of like that song, sort of. I mean, I don't love it, or you know, it's got a thing. I don't. What other fucking songs are on that record?
I don't know.
Is this? Lick It Up is one of their biggest songs, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, they seem to be in that situation, kind of like a fucking glider or something, where it's like they'll have massive success and then like fuck it up for themselves. And just when they're about to start going down below like 3,000 or 4,000 people at their concerts, there'll be something that will literally boost them back up. Like, you know,
well, this was the first public appearance without makeup by the band. Okay. Et cetera, et cetera. 1983. I mean, it doesn't, the video is a bit weird, rapey, isn't it? Something a bit odd about it. And I think Vinnie Vincent on this record?
I think he is, yeah.
He is, yeah. And
one afterwards.
Vinnie Vincent is very odd in that video. There's some weird things going on in that video. If you don't know the Lick It Up video, have a little look at it. And in the end, I think they get their comeuppance by a bunch of sort of women, don't they, like electrocuting them or something in a bar, you know? So maybe some justice.
Yeah, but it's so considering that Spinal Tap was about to come out, it's insanely accurate, like whatever they were talking about the cover of their album. It's like, oh man.
Well, it says here that the album marked a turnaround from the band's flagging fortunes of the previous few years. There you go.
Yeah, because it made a couple of clunkers, hadn't it, that people didn't like, music from the Elder and
Yeah. Lick It Up was certified platinum by December 1990. Okay.
Right, well, that's not particularly good, is it, considering that all their popular albums had gone platinum immediately? Like, you know? Yeah, but like, this is on this list by just a fucking, it is a hard rock album, and, you know, fair play to Kiss.
Well, the next record, I don't know, Steeler. Now, I know Yngwie was in Steeler, right? And then he was replaced by that guy who doesn't seem to be very good to me. What's a guy, a German guy with the big hair? Or is that a different Steeler? No, it's not. It's the same Steeler, isn't it?
No, there's two Steelers, I think. There's Steeler from Germany and Steeler from America, I think.
Really?
Anyway, I think so. Now, I could be wrong. People of the comments, if you know.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, I have the Steeler German one, and it, certainly the guitar player is a big fucking step down from Yngwie. Steeler was a 1980s American band. Featured Yngwie Malmsteen. Okay.
And Graham Bonnot, I think. Or no, that was the Alcatraz, wasn't it?
Wow, and the singer is Ron Keel. Okay, and that's Rudy Sarzo. Is it on the bass? The original lineup, Ron Keel on vocals and rhythm guitar, Bobby Eva, Tim Morrison, blah, blah, blah. Just going back for a minute, the guy who was playing the bass in Dokken on that German thing in 81, that's the guy from Rat, what's his name?
Juan Crozier, is it? Or?
That's it, yeah, he's on that. Anyway, yeah, Steeler. A lot of time to spend on a record. I don't know this record at all, Steeler. Okay, Shout of the Devil. Well, now I'm a fan.
But and like same management company, Q Prime, who are looking after Def Leppard, Pyromania. You know, I think they had some involvement with Crocus for a while, and like, you know, they picked up Metallica
Ed Farley
a year later. But and they were working with Dokken at that stage, but this is like their next big huge here we go, Break America project. And man, what a successful record. Like,
yeah, and it sounds huge for people, any kind of haters of the record or whatever. I mean, it's a the drum sound is massive. The guitar tone is dirty and filthy. Singing isn't that annoying, which is quite incredible, but it's got bangers on it, you know. What is
it? I think they did a really, really excellent, like, and there's probably a lot of people who do are very serious about their metal, don't dig this, but like, I think that they did a brilliant job of trying to mix the kind of aspect of Venom and Sabbath, where it was supposed to be evil, but yeah, also kind of, you know, the, I know, the Van Halen-y, like, we want women to like this, but it also has to be the people who want, like, Satan in their music.
Well, let's just say it's got an edge. It's a bit dangerous. It's got big choruses, but it's got a bit of filth. And they did look like how they looked in the album inlay. And can you imagine picking up that album inlay and going, look at these cunts, and thinking, they can't surely look like this. But, I mean, Looks That Kill, Too Young to Fall in Love, banger, 10 Seconds to Love. You know, it's
the devil. Well, the title track is an awesome one. You can see so much why people were looking at something like Flick of the Switch by AC/DC or this and being all like, well, you know, or Lick It Up and being all like, yeah, this clearly seems way more legitimate and cool and relevant. Like, you know,
and it's young and it's exciting and it's got a bit of fucking evil to it, you know. 500 copies, apparently it says here, but I'm not really too sure about that, but. Yeah, it's a banger of a record. I couldn't tell you that I liked it in the 80s, but I picked it up in vinyl somewhere in the 90s and was kind of like, because it just sort of sat way nearer to Wasp than I imagined in my head. Because I'm not
a big mama as well. Like, you know, it's one of those things that, like, kind of like Number of the Beast, where it took a band from being, you know, opening for 38 Special or whoever the fuck was to really, really dominant.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, Girls Goes Girls has two good songs. The rest of it's rubbish. Dr. Phil.
Theater of Pain is definitely the one followed it.
Theater of Pain is awful. Record.
There's some good songs on it, but like, even the production, it's one of those albums kind of like Pleasures of the Flesh, where the immediate thing you go is like, what has happened with the drums? Why do the drums sound so bizarre? Why is the production so weird looking?
It's all kind of muffly and, I mean, you got Smokey.
Do you know who's the opening band for the Theatre of Pain tour?
Running Wild. Exciter, were they? Wow. Yeah.
That's a good coup, isn't it? Look.
Yeah, you wouldn't mind that.
Maybe that's worth the 3 million records.
The next record I don't think I've ever even seen on the list. Alice Cooper, Dada. I don't
even, I think this is the one where he had short hair, I think.
I know.
Or there's maybe it's called In the Army or fucking, I don't know.
I have no clue. I've never even seen this record. So fuck it. Riot, Born in America. Look at this. This is the day three. Because I feel like you've got Fire Down Under is 90 or 80. Sorry.
The first two albums are set 78, 79, 80. And then is there no album in 81? No, Fire Down Under is definitely from 81, man. So,
well, this it says here, this is the fifth Riot album.
And you know what? People can skip to the previous episode where we sat there going, now, what order did they come out in? Because we always end up trying to think of what order Riot albums come out in. Doesn't matter. But yeah, and we've also talked about the album cover of this. So,
okay,
let's move on.
Alcatraz, No Parole from Rock and Roll. Now, I don't know this record. I have a friend. Who I play football with, who swears by this record. Like he still has a whole bunch of Alcatraz shirts and always after 5 or 6 beers wants, this is what he wants to hear. And you're just like, okay. But I don't. The album cover is quite special, isn't it? It's kind of like a floating rock with a sort of jail.
Yeah, because it's Alcatraz. Like it's the rock Alcatraz, isn't it?
Yeah. The logo is very, do you think Anthrax robbed a bit off this logo?
Yeah, I'd say like that'd probably be exactly it. They would be sitting idolizing Alcatraz, being like, one day we'll be like Alcatraz, one glorious day.
I must admit, again, I don't know this.
But it's definitely for Americans. I don't like they probably did tour in Germany and stuff like that, and maybe Germans are into this, or it'd be on, like it's definitely a kind of Sweden rock type band, Alcatraz. Yeah,
isn't this also Yngwie though, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Graham Bonnet, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But I think they're quite transferable in terms of material. One of the bands has got a song called Backseat Driver, which is
Why not?
You know, same as like any Ron Keel type product where you're just going to be rocking out with Keel, like, you know.
I'm sure that's available on their OnlyFans or whatever, or their website or something. You can rock out, hang out with them for the weekend. Violent Breed rocks. Never heard this record. My mate Eric will be like, I thought you knew all the metal records. Don't know this one. Oh, okay. Now we're talking. Merciful Fate, Melissa. Oof.
There you go.
Now, something else happening here. Could be the greatest heavy metal debut of all time, Melissa.
It's certainly one of my favorite album covers. I think that like the art looks so cool, and like it brings you into the zone, you know, like kind of like same as Maiden. You're all of a sudden in the right atmosphere for the music and everything about it.
It's a step up from everything in the sense that, well, you know, this and Don't Break the Oath, this is a band who are on another level compared to everybody else, whether it's the solos, the songwriting, the riffs, the musicianship. It's just, you've got the whole thing. And Melissa just sounds incredible. And it's evil heavy metal. Curse of the Pharaoh is evil. It's just, as a debut, I can hard push to think what's a better heavy metal debut than this. I mean, it's better than
it's a very well made record as well. You know, for like, it does kind of have that same vibe as the first Maiden album, but everything is just really tightly played. And like, whenever we've been looking at the insane list of Euro metal that we've been, you know, going through here, none of it sounds really like, is there any European bands on this list whose album sounds as good as this? Maybe like Raven All for One has the same production quality.
I don't think so.
Before, but you know what I mean? Like, as in, like, you could tell that Merciful Fate were extremely serious musicians as well as like
way more serious than nearly every band. Yeah. And it's the solos and it's the attention to small detail with the riffs and stuff they're on a different plane to almost every other band in this, you know. And it's evil heavy metal, you know. It's a stone cold, one of the greatest heavy metal records.
I do think it is kind of slightly a product of its times, in the sense that like it is a bit like a evil Danish version of Number of the Beast in places, you know.
Mm.
Like there's, you know, disco beats and stuff like that on it, and on things of that nature, which you might not necessarily associate.
Well, it's got some shuffling stuff on it. Yeah, the drummer, I mean, he's got some game. But yeah, it's just, I think there's everything about it, but especially just, it's the attention to small little details and the riffing and the trading solos back and forth. I mean,
I think that's part of the Maiden stroke Priest sort of influence, where they're
it's Priest.
Not only this music has to be pretty ferocious, but it has to be full of guitar solos, you know. Yeah.
I mean, it's the influence of Priest in it, you know.
And that's something I have to say, man, about modern heavy metal that I don't like, you know, is that I think that like guitar solos are something that people love about this kind of music, you know, and like you don't have to necessarily do them all in the same kind of way, but like I think it'd be better if fans tried to approach their music saying, let's have a cool guitar bit that people like, instead of saying, you know, that's a pastiche or fucking, you know, very 80s way of looking at stuff.
Mm. Next is Witchfinder General, My Friends of Hell. I love this record. I love it. I'm trying to track it down in the end of the 80s. It was a quest to find records by them, Pentagram, Saint Vitus, Proto Doom,
that sort of stuff.
Yeah, to find those records and I remember one somewhere, it must be maybe 89, 90 or 91. I'd got tape traded a few Doom stuff, but one day in some record store or other, I found the first Angel Witch, Friends of Hell, and a few Saint Vitus records, and they were like £2 and £3 each. And it was just like for 10 quid or for 14 quid, I got that Holy Grail fucking.
So crazy, isn't it? Because whenever you think about it, like, not only would people be paying 30 or 40 quid now for a record, but Back then, like, it was like whenever I was discovering all those like sort of nuclear assault records, I would have happily paid a tenner for them. But because it was so same as kind of fucking Witchfinder General at that stage, so out of the fucking out of vogue, you know, you were getting them for a quid or 50p. You could literally buy an entire band's discography for fuck all.
Yeah, know? I mean, I have I think five St. Vitus records from the '80s, and I got all five for like £10 in like 90 or something or 91.
Yeah,
and that was
it's
just
so like, crazy as well. Like people will never understand that younger people who are well, I suppose they will because they want like if they grew up having this music totally available to them on Spotify or whatever, it's instant gratification, so you can listen to it. But I say if you have the instant gratification of getting into violence or whoever it is, they only made like 30,000 or 40,000 violence copies of Eternal Nightmare, and I would say that most of them have been taken up by people who love the band. So it's not the same as it was 20 or 30 years ago where there's thousands of unsold copies sitting about waiting for people to get, you know.
There's something weird about it. Witchfinder General, for example, is that they're a band who seem to exist in their shire, so to speak, played in pubs in a few places around where they were from. They don't seem to have ever gone on tour in Europe or played festivals. They made their two albums and then they were gone. But they were around from what, like, you know, you've got The Burning of Sinner, you've got the Soviet Invasion, 12-inch and stuff, but they had about 4 or 5 years where they had a go. But they don't, I can't find any record of them doing like a German tour in 82 or something. Seems like you had to support somebody huge or forget about it, you know?
Also, yeah, probably was.
The album cover is fucking hilarious. It's just, I wonder how much they paid all those girls on the cover.
Yeah. So, man, what about Tokyo Blade?
Well, and we're going to skip over Pandemonium. I don't even know this record. Tokyo Blade, yeah, I like this record. Heaven is Hell, or whatever it is. Yeah, I'm a fan of Tokyo Blade. I'm not a huge fan, but I like them. It's kind of...
Now, this had a bit of a following in Europe, though, didn't it? Yeah. Like, there are those bands that if you look at all those early Art Shock Dags and, you know, proto-metal festivals, as you said, and stuff, they were hanging around there until about 85, 86.
I would say they were a band who must have had somebody good management. It seems to be a lot back then about who manages you. But you're right, they're everywhere.
They straddled a bit of a line where I think that because something like Shroud at the Devil or Quiet Riot had been a success, and at least in England, the news of its success had come around, that, you know, maybe management people were like, yeah, this seems like a good bet. You know, let's try and buck behind these guys.
Realistically, it's sort of like Heavy Hair, isn't it? It's sort of a bit clammy, new wave British heavy metal. But this is a good record. Yeah, I own this one somewhere.
I think so as well. And yeah, I think musically...
Oof.
Go on.
Next, the last three albums. I mean, our Bark at the Moon, Show No Mercy, and Balls to the Wall, and then it's over. Oof.
Yeah, outrageous, isn't it?
It's a strong ending to the year, isn't it? I mean,
and like three totally different kind of, you know, genres of heavy rock music. Like, you know, you've got the most unbelievably commercial, million selling, like career changing album, Bark at the Moon, and then a pretender to that throne with Balls to the Wall, and then Show No Mercy, which is like, you know, an underground, you're like.
I mean, I would say
that Slayer were just as influenced by the Aussies solo stuff on Accept as they would have been by Venom at that stage. They weren't an out-and-out fucking, you know, black metal band, I don't think. I think the vibe was like, let's rock out.
I think Show No Mercy is satanic speed metal. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, the back inverted crosses and eyeliner and stuff.
I think it's also a heavy metal record. I think they could have been in some way influenced by fucking the vibe of what was going on with Motley Crue on Shout at the Devil. Like, it's not a million miles away. You know?
No, I mean, now looking back, it isn't. But back then, I think it was. I think there'd been no doubt would have been influenced by Fast as a Shark. Every Fast band was influenced by Fast as a Shark, and except when it came out, that was hugely influential. But I think Show No Mercy is just Judas Priest on meth. That's what it is. Cryonics, Final Command. But also you can see the moment where Slayer obviously heard Venom, where there's a moment where they were like, you know, the stripy shirts and the kind of little, you know, spandexy stuff. And then it's like black metal. Obviously somebody came down to the rehearsal room with it, went, you got to hear this. And literally you could probably see like a week later.
I don't know about that, man. Because to me, it seems like they were huge Maiden and Priest type fans when they were doing those covers, as you said, wearing the stripy docking shirts and stuff. But like, I kind of think that by the time that, you know, their first album had come out, right, they were definitely influenced by the Venom thing visually and like slightly musically. But I think that they were banking on the idea that a lot of the people who were going to listen to the band were Motley Crue type fans who wanted satanic theatrical.
I would disagree. I think, and even that Slayer themselves would have said it at the time, we were the antidote to all that crap. The same with Metallica and stuff. I think they were just into
This is the thing. They might be saying that after the fact, but that's only because they had an audience full of people who were cutting their names into their arms, you know?
Well,
at that stage, they were being all like, you know what would be great? If we could get fucking some of these people who like, you know, fucking like Iron Maiden and Motley Crue to listen to our band.
But I think you forget how divisive that whole hair rock thing was compared to something like Slayer. I mean, Slayer, Kill 'Em All, and this were seen as the kind of, you know, the antidote to some of that big hair stuff. And now we can look back and go, doesn't Motley Crue look a bit like Sarcophago in 85 or 86 a little bit? You know, the altar and the pentagram and the big hair. And you can go, yeah, Motley Crue looks a bit like Death SS, looks a bit like whatever. But I think at the time, there was a big division. I mean, you listen to Evil Has No Boundaries. I mean, it's just pure, you know, it rushes out of the gate like a fucking faster black metal, and it's with fucking, it's just coincidence-ish, I think, that they happen to have some of the same eyeliner and leather and stuff like this and that. But I think it's more firmly in the Venom black metal camp than, you know, they were hoping that Motley Crue fans were going to listen to it. But the Maiden Priest stuff, I think, it's perfectly correct, you know?
Yeah, well, I would say, like, image-wise, it was probably more of a Motley Crue thing. I don't think that there's any songs from the first Slayer record
I don't think they were influenced by Motley Crue's image. I think that kind of image was ubiquitous amongst an awful lot of bands in irrespective or independent of each other. I mean, if you listen to the progression from this, Haunting the Chapel, you could argue, is fucking death metal. I mean, you know, the song Haunting the Chapel, for me, is, you can hear Morbid Angel easily in this. I don't know. I mean, you've got Kill 'Em All earlier in the year and then Show No Mercy. I mean, and the cover is kind of goofy and cartoonish, which has a kind of cool kitsch to it now. But at the time, you're thinking maybe it could have been a bit more.
Show No Mercy?
Yeah.
I think it's got a really cool cover of a Dennis Wheatley novel from the 60s type vibe about it. You know,
The guy is
drawn in a way that if somebody told me that it was a lift from something like that, I wouldn't be surprised. But they could back then. So
he's not as muscly as some of the other muscular, you know, characters we've seen throughout this list, though. I mean, yeah. Although he has.
I would like to think that that was a personal decision by Slayer, where they said, we would like him to have fur on his arms instead of having huge biceps.
He has very big biceps, but he's got furry legs.
Okay.
He's also got little denim hot pant kind of things going on. So, like, they never. Here's the difference, is like, you get this record, and then you get Hellhammer Apocalyptic Rage, which is like,
It's the same guy from the cover of Welcome to Hell, isn't it? Black Metal. It's the same goat dude.
It's the same Baphomet.
What's the movie? The Devil Rides Out. You know when Satan arrives and the Devil rides out? That's what his head looks
originally
like.
Originally, that Baphomet drawing was done by this guy called Eliphas de Levi or something. An early Victorian occultist or something.
So that's where that comes from.
Maybe
he's even like, you know, in the thrash metal world, guys.
That's even 1820 or 1810 or 1840 or something like this. But yeah, he was a kind of proto-occultist kind of thing. And that's where the first Baphomet came from.
So, like, clearly, like, massively, massively influential record now. But at the time, you know,
I think it was considered a bit of a joke by people in the press. And they were like, this will never last. Because people were just kind of shocked and didn't know what to think about it. And I think speaking to people who were around at the time, you know, this is a bit before our time, they were like, when Haunting the Chapel came out, people were like, oh, fuck. They heard Chemical Warfare for the first time. This is like, oh, this band, you got to consider them in a much, much more serious way. And then, of course, Hell Awaits is a whole other kettle of evil, you know.
So, like, Bark at the Moon, again, man, like, obviously a really, really polished and like sort of $1 million production kind of scenario. Like, has it aged as well?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.